You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows in Kansas. According to the American Wind Energy Association, Kansas has the second highest potential for wind energy in the United States, and the state is increasing its wind energy production at a breakneck pace. Recently, legislation that some would consider to be the driving force behind that activity was contested. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we'll get the lowdown on the politics and science of wind turbines. Later in the hour, we'll get a sneak peek at our local music festival, Middle of the Map, and get your predictions about the Royals season. That's coming up right after this news. In 2009, Kansas adopted a mandate requiring utility companies in the state to achieve specific benchmarks for renewable energy over the next several years. Fast forward to 2014. Renewable energy is on the table again. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning we will be talking about the issues at stake. Joining us now is Andy Marceau, of the Topeka Capital Journal, who's been closely watching and reporting on this story for the past few years. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning.
So summarize the renewable energy mandate that was written into law in 2009. Where did it come from and exactly what does it stipulate?
Yeah, I'm hearing audio. And
yeah, sure thing. So in 2009, Governor Parkinson took over and he struck a deal with conservative lawmakers who had been clamoring for a permit for a coal power plant out in Holcomb, Kansas. And in exchange for that permit, Governor Parkinson got the votes for the renewable portfolio standards, which basically say that starting in 2016, Kansas utilities are supposed to get 16% of their, no, sorry, starting in 2016, Kansas utilities are supposed to get 15% of their electricity from renewable sources, and then that goes up to 20% by 2020. So the benchmark goal is 20% renewables by 2020.
So could you summarize what kind of, in the process of that getting written into law in the first place, what each side kind of got out of the deal?
Right. So the folks who wanted the coal power plant, they needed a permit from the Department of Health and Environment, which is an executive branch office. So Governor Parkinson agreed to issue that permit, and the permit was issued. But then subsequently, a lot of environmentalist groups filed suit, and the coal power plant has never been built. It's been mired in litigation, and so there's some, I guess, Some folks who struck that deal are disgruntled because they say, well, we didn't get the coal power plant that we wanted, but we still got these renewable energy mandates. And so every year then, for the last few years, we've had an effort to repeal the standards. And ironically, it looks like the coal power plant may actually be moving forward now, but we still are having these efforts to repeal the standards.
So other than the coal power plant getting mired in litigation, what else has happened on this front in the last few years? It seems like on the other side, some activity has been taking place as well.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting because like with a lot of things here, there's a lot of arguments and counterarguments. So, I mean, the first argument that opponents of these standards make is that, well, they're going to cost us money. And there's been a lot of cost studies done by the Kansas Corporation Commission, which runs the utilities here in Kansas, and most of the cost studies say that the renewable standards cost about 2%. And so,
what does that mean? 2%.
2% more than if you could buy your energy from any source.
Okay. Carry on.
Right. So you know, then people who are fans of renewable energy say, okay, well, that's not very much, no big deal. The opponents of the standards say, well, okay, so that might not be a big deal to somebody who lives in a one-bedroom apartment, but scale that up to a heavy industry business that uses a lot of electricity, 2% can be an actual cost. It's then going to be passed on to consumers, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that argument, but then there's also the counter argument to that, which is that some heavy industry doesn't mind paying that cost and in fact will seek it out. Like, for instance, Mars recently opened a plant here in Topeka to produce M&Ms, and they came to Kansas and located in Kansas in part because of these renewable standards, because part of their corporate culture says we want to, you know, operate in a sustainable fashion. So there's the counter argument, is that yes, it may cost more for some industries, but it's actually attracting other industries. And another argument that that those in favor of repeal make is that if your grid relies too much on renewable sources, it becomes less reliable. And you have seen this a little bit in places like Germany, where they are using a higher percentage of renewable sources, and then the grid can become somewhat dodgy for heavy electricity users, like, again, your big industrial places. So,
what have been the consequences of that in Germany? You mentioned Germany as an example.
What's that?
What have been the consequences of that in Germany? You mentioned Germany as an example.
Well, I mean, it's some of the consequences has been that some of the plants over there, the heavy industry type places, like I know one aluminum place, for instance, they had power outages that cost them, you know, some money, like in the thousands of dollars. And so then as a consequence, they then went out and bought batteries, generators, backup type energy sources that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to just make sure that their assembly lines didn't shut down again. Because anytime you lose electricity in an operation like that and the line shuts down, it's going to be costly. But the counter argument to that is that, look, 20% is not going to cause that sort of thing in general. So, I mean, the standards over in Europe are quite a bit higher.
So bringing it back to Kansas, the Kansas Senate sought to repeal those energy standards that were written into law in 2009 with Senate Bill 433. What was behind that move, and why has the House rejected the repeal not once, not twice, but three times?
Right. Well, I guess the driving force this year is a couple different groups. One is Americans for Prosperity, and everybody, I think, kind of knows who they are. They are a free market advocacy group co-founded several years ago by one of the Koch brothers down in Wichita. And so they've run a six-figure ad campaign this year basically advocating repealing the standards. And their lobbyist here in Topeka has said that repeal of RPS is one of their top priorities this year. And
why?
So,
why is that? Why is that such a priority?
Well, he just says it's, for him, it sounds like it's basically purely ideological. What he says is it's not a free market idea, is that, you know, this government mandate, it's not a free market idea, and they're a free market organization that wants free market ideas. Now, the counter argument to that is, as given by Senator Marcy Francisco from Lawrence, is, look, you know, utilities in Kansas are not a free market to begin with. It's basically a set of heavily regulated regional monopolies. So her constituents in Lawrence, if they want to get energy from renewable sources, they can't, you know, say, well, I'm going to shop around for a different utility company. They all get whoever serves Lawrence. So it's kind of, you know, obviously it's an ideological argument, but I think the gist of it is that, you know, they just don't like government mandates in any way, shape, or form. So.
But interestingly, the Kansas Senate and the Kansas House aren't ideologically opposed, are they?
Well, no. I mean, they're both Republican and heavily Republican, but this is an issue that kind of splits up the Republican Party, and it comes down to basically parochial interests. You know, there's, in the Senate, it passed, I believe, about 25 to 15, something like that. But in the House, it failed by a pretty wide margin, because there's a lot of House members who are Republicans from rural districts, and they've seen a whole lot of benefit from the wind industry. And it's one of the few industries that's actually wanting to go out and locate in rural Kansas and create high-paying jobs out there. And so those fellows are, and ladies, those representatives who come from those areas, are they're their district's interest is in keeping the wind industry happy, and the wind industry obviously wants to keep the renewable portfolio standards in place. So I think that's the driving force behind why the House has rejected this multiple times this session, is they want to keep this in place because a lot of the Republican House members from places like, you know, Dodge City and Pratt County and places like that, where they're seeing a lot of economic growth due to investment in wind, they want to keep those standards around.
So Andy Marceau of the Topeka Capital Journal, if I understand you correctly, it sounds like you're saying that with the split not falling neatly along party lines, it's falling kind of along geographic and maybe industry lines.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. I mean, if you're a conservative Republican from Johnson County, you may vote for this repeal effort because, you know, you don't have a whole lot of interest in wind locally, and, you know, you can improve your Americans for Prosperity scorecard for the next election. If you're from out in western Kansas, everybody in your district has seen those wind turbines, and they probably, you know, may know somebody who's gotten a job because of those wind turbines, and so they're not going to be real happy with you if you vote to repeal the standards that the wind industry says help bring those turbines to your district. So it does, I think, come down more to geographic lines than to party lines on this one.
Well, you mentioned earlier that one of the major sticking points is this claim that energy costs are going up or will go up as a result of this mandate. Is anyone looking into steps that can be taken to bring those down, or is there anything in substantial behind those claims?
Yeah, I mean, it goes both ways. There's some people who say, look, the cost of renewables are going to decrease because the technology is getting better. We're getting better at storing this energy. We're getting better at transmitting it efficiently. And then there's other folks who say, well, the cost is going to go up. And the main rationale behind that is that the federal government, up until the beginning of this year, offered a pretty substantial tax credit for investment in wind. And so now that that's gone away, now, the people who are trying to repeal the standards say, we need to repeal these before the cost of wind energy skyrockets because we've lost this federal tax credit. So it's, again, it's a point of contention with a lot of arguments and counterarguments. But, I mean, the votes, the counterarguments and arguments are there, but the votes always seem to basically come down to geography.
Tell me more about the tax credit.
That's a federal thing, so it's not really my, area of expertise. But as I understand it, this was something put in place by President Obama. It's been in place for several years. It's sort of a capital investment type of assistance so that companies that are looking to build wind farms can get a sizable tax credit to do so. And then that, in turn, allows them, when they sign these 20-year electricity purchase agreements with the utilities, to offer the wind energy to the utilities at a lower price because they've paid less to set up their operation. And so then, in turn, the utilities are able to offer that energy to their ratepayers at a lower rate. And so the argument would be that now that federal tax credit is going away, it's going to cost the wind energy people more to set up their wind farms in the first place. They're going to have to charge the utility companies more to recoup that initial investment. The utility companies then are going to have to pass that on to the ratepayers, and you're going to see your rates go up. And there was one fairly influential House member who went to the House floor and said, very emphatically, you're constituents are going to see their energy bills rise 40%. And there was this sort of unusual outcry from the chamber of people saying no and kind of interrupting him, basically taking issue with that figure and saying it's pure speculation and there's no basis for it. But, those things are all over the map, kind of the estimates of what it could cost in the future. And some are estimating it's going to be less, some are estimating it's going to be more, and it's kind of hard to sort through all the claims and counterclaims.
Well, it sounds like in intention anyway, the tax credit was intended, if I understand, to ease startup costs and then to pass along the easing of those startup costs to customers. But so that brings me to the question of how far along are are we in the state of Kansas in terms of working toward reaching those renewable energy standards with the first deadline 2 years from now in 2016? Has a lot of that startup already happened, or are we still waiting for it to happen?
Right, and that's a good question. And actually, the first deadline, I should have been more clear, was earlier. I think it was maybe 2012. They wanted 10% of our energy to come from renewables, and we hit that target. And the utility companies that have come into the hearings on this thing have said that most of them have said that they're not having any problems at all hitting that 15% mark by 2016. And
it sounds like we are on pace.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically this wind boom has certainly helped. There's still transmission issues as to how to get some of that wind energy to all of the places that need it. But the utility companies that I've heard from have mostly said that, look, we hit the 10% mark in 2011 like we wanted to. We're on track, if not having already surpassed the 15% mark for 2016. The 20% in 2020 is still a bit of a question, but 2020 is also 6 years away. So there's going to be time for more investment by renewable companies. There's going to be technological advancements, one would guess. And right now we seem to be on track. It's not really the utility companies that are asking for this to be rolled back. It's these sort of quote-unquote free market groups, Americans for Prosperity, the Kansas Chamber of Commerce joined them, and then I think Kansans for Liberty, a group out of Wichita, another free market group. So, yeah, it's not the utility companies. They haven't voiced too many concerns about these targets. It's more been the free market groups, and they'll argue, well, you know, the utility companies are just going to pass the costs on to the ratepayer, so it's no skin off their neck.
So, excuse me, is the bill to repeal these standards, is it dead, or is there still a chance we could be hearing more about that?
Well, the running gag in the legislature is, when I get old, bring me to the state house because that's where nothing ever dies. And so it's as dead as a bill can be up here because the House has voted it down and voted down a motion to reconsider it. But, you know, it can always be tacked on to something and it can come up again. There's rumors floating around here about, well, what bill are they going to try and put RPS repeal on? It just seems like, I mean, it failed by more than 25 votes in the House. They would have to twist a lot of arms to switch that many votes. And this late in the session, it seems unlikely. But like I said, nothing's ever dead here until they leave town for good.
Well, on that note, Andy Marso of the Topeka Capital Journal, I want to thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you.
And now we'll turn this conversation to our next guest. But if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I've been talking to reporter Andy Marso about the politics of renewable energy in Kansas. Now let's switch gears to hear about the science of renewable energy, wind energy in particular. Biometeorologist Nate Brunzel is here with us to help us out with that. Welcome to Central Standard, Nate.
Thank you for having me.
What does it mean to be a biometeorologist?
It means I study the interactions between the Earth's surface and the atmosphere. So predominantly I look at how vegetation reacts to climate change at a whole range of scales, from the leaf all the way up to global climate.
Well, on the most basic level, can you explain how it is that usable energy is extracted from the wind?
Sure. As the wind blows, that's a lot of energy that goes into the movement of those air particles. And you can harvest that wind, basically, through the use of turbines. And so as the turbines are spinning, you can use a generator and you can harvest that energy from that motion of the air.
Geographically, what is it that makes the relationship between wind and Kansas so attractive? It seems this discussion of renewable energy in Kansas has settled very quickly on wind.
Yeah, so I forget the exact number, but I think we're ranked second or so in terms of state potential for wind energy. And a lot of that has to do with this thing called the low-level jet, which is what is responsible for most of the wind in Kansas. It's this air that's moving up from the Gulf of Mexico through Texas and Oklahoma in here. And so then that combined with the topography and just kind of where we are right in the middle of the country is makes an ideal situation for having lots of wind blowing past.
Something I remember reading once as far as a definition of the prairie goes is that there has to be just a very small number of trees per square foot of land, say. Is that part of this equation?
No, I don't think so. I mean, historically, yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, that's kind of what set the grasslands of the central U.S. apart was that lack of trees. Although, you know, we're seeing a lot more trees coming in, mostly with the suppression of burning by the farmers, and you know, people don't want to burn their backyard so much. So we're seeing more trees coming in, particularly in eastern Kansas. But I think we'd still have quite a bit of wind energy even with the trees coming in.
This concept of wind energy to the layperson sounds like this kind of too good to be true almost kind of scenario, because it sounds like what people are saying is that the energy is just out there in the air for the taking. Is it really as simple as that, or are there lesser known complications?
Well, there's quite a few complications. I mean, I think that we do have a lot of wind energy available to us, and we can definitely exploit a lot more than we are. I think the thing to consider, and one of the things that we're looking at, is how as you add turbines to a certain location, as you build wind farms larger and larger and larger, that there's a certain amount of energy in that air as it goes past. And as you harvest that energy, as you extract that energy, that leaves less energy for the next turbine. So kind of on a per turbine basis, as you're adding more and more turbines, you could have less and less energy being extracted.
So it's not just limitless.
Correct. And I think that that's one thing that's a lot of the assessments that have been done previously by the National Renewable Energy Lab and others have kind of failed to take into that account. And I mean, we're talking huge extractions. I mean, kind of covering the entire state with turbines kind of levels, nothing that we're kind of talking about with the RPS or something like that levels. These would be much higher levels.
So you don't think that 20% of the energy needed to power Kansas homes, businesses, et cetera, is too much for what we theoretically have available in our wind?
No, I think that's a very, not easy standard, but that's a very good standard to aim for.
What about ecological repercussions of wind energy production? Are there any, and what are they?
Yeah, so there have been studies. A lot of studies have focused on things like bird and bat habitats and migration patterns and how through the spinning of the turbines, I think the idea is that there's a low frequency noises being emitted by the turbines as they spin. And so that kind of screws up the bat sonars and things like that. And then just having the blade spinning, sometimes you have, you know, bird impacts. So that's some issues there. There's some people out at Kansas State University that research that area. But there's on other sides, if you're putting turbines in agricultural fields, there have been some studies that have shown up in Iowa that you can actually mix carbon dioxide down from higher up in the atmosphere and make it more available to plants. So plants take in this carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's how they grow. And so you can actually mix that down and kind of – it's called CO2 fertilization. And so you can kind of get more carbon dioxide into plants through the mixing of the turbines.
Interesting.
The downside of that, I mean, that sounds like a perfect thing, of course, but the downside is that they also lose water in that process. So as you go out further into western Kansas, where water is already a limiting factor, you know, getting more carbon growth, getting more yield from plants will mean more water is necessary to do that growth.
Huh. Well, and one of the other things you mentioned is that as we extract energy from the wind contains less of this energy that we're trying to harvest. Is there any reason to be concerned about the wind having less of that energy in it for reasons other than for wind farming?
Yeah. So, again, we're kind of talking global scale things. There's been some studies that have shown if you cover the entire United States with turbines, so kind of completely unrealistic levels of turbines, that you can actually start altering things like rainfall patterns and airflow patterns. And there was a study, I forget who the authors were, but it showed kind of wind farms in the central U.S. could affect temperatures in Europe and things like that through weird teleconnections. So these are potentials, and it's one of those things that we kind of think as we're building up this portfolio of renewable energy, we kind of think it's better to be that knowledge should be obtained now if possible, just to know what the potential consequences are. Of course, with something that we're actually talking about, feasible limits of turbines and wind farms, I don't think we'll see that kind of impact.
I'd love to hear actually what you were going to say.
One of the other sides is within the wind farms, though, we see kind of very pretty severe microclimate impacts. I mean, severe is probably too big of a word, but we could see because you're stopping the wind from flowing in this area, in these areas, you're harvesting that energy, you're slowing the wind down. What you're seeing is actually increases in temperature within the wind farms, particularly at night. So you might see a degree or two increase in temperature.
So that sounds like a kind of climate change type factor.
Yeah. So that obviously will have some issues related to if you're growing fields, if the wind turbines, if a farmer's leasing out that area to put the turbines in, that might have some impact on evaporation and water use and things like that.
Well, speaking of farmers who are leasing out their land for wind turbines, we have one such farmer on the line, Scott Brown, a farmer and real estate broker, among other things, in Mullenville, Kansas, who has leased his land for the production of wind energy. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
So how does that work? How does the process of becoming someone who leases his land out for wind energy work?
Well, actually, the companies like Exelon, which is the one that has the wind farm here south of Mullenville, they go out and do their research on where they think the best areas in the state would be to harvest the wind. And they've, in this case, picked an area in Kiowa County out in southwest Kansas. And there seems to be a good area there and a good, they study that with little mini turbines for several years. And then they come out to the, local farmers and, try to put together a package, of people that are willing to lease their property and, say they want to put in this case, 65 of these wind turbines. And they're strung out over, several thousand acres, and they have to contact each individual land operator and owner and see if they can get a package put together of those folks that are willing to allow that to happen and put that together and make a sizable acreage so it makes it feasible for their project. And that's what happened out here.
How long did that take?
Well, in this case, I expect they studied the wind for probably 2 or 3 years, and then they started acquiring the leases, and they initially started giving you a 5-year lease assuming that they would have the project done within 5 years. And then they also added on there a 2-year extension in case it was not done. In this case, they ran that full 7 years and then realized they were actually getting close enough to have the thing come into realization that they leased the property for an additional 3 years. So out here, it was 10-year lease where they just paid the landowners an annual lease to reserve that property for this project if it does develop, and they paid that for 10 years before they actually started the project on site.
So don't take this question the wrong way, but what's in all of this for you?
Well, for 10 years, it was just very simple. They agreed to pay so much per parcel lease, and they paid lease money, so it's kind of like bending over and finding it because they did very little. After the project is developed, then, of course, it is financially more rewarding to the landowners because they get quite a little bit more than the original lease money. They get so much per turbine, and they get a yearly payment per turbine, and or if the turbine produces over a certain amount of energy, they get an override at the end of the year if that turbine's produced more energy than a certain level. So what's in it for us, the landowners, is just like a small oil well. In other words, you're getting some income rather than off of wheat or corn or soybeans or grass or whatever.
So in your case, your valuable natural resource is your air, your wind.
Yeah, and of course we have no control over it, and we have plenty of it out here in western Kansas. So we are harvesting a resource that a number of years ago, well, I mean, they've been harvesting winds way back in the dirty 30s, but now it's more on a commercial use. It used to be strictly for a residence where they would store the wind energy and batteries and use it, you know, for different things on the farm. But that went by a long time ago when rural electric came into the country.
Explain what you mean.
Wind energy.
Yeah, explain what you're referring to with wind harvesting in the dirty 30s.
Well, back there, I can't think what they called them, but you would have wind, little bitty wind turbines, only they'd be more like livestock windmills, and they would harvest the wind, and a lot of people would have batteries in their basement or in their side deal, and they would charge their batteries up, and then they would have a battery. It's not quite as simple as this, but just like you would think a car battery, you would have energy stored in that battery, and you could use that that resource to power things in your house.
Okay.
Now, of course, what we're talking about on modern-day turbines, there's not the battery like that. This energy goes right into a main power line and services energy needs all across wherever they have the lines go to. In this case, goes to a lot of the cities.
Well, we'll get to run some of this past our biometeorologist Nate Brunzel from KU, who's on the line in a moment. But I want to ask you quickly, Scott Brown, how the people in Mullenville, Kansas, and the surrounding area have been responding to you as a wind turbine guy.
Well, I'm not known as a wind turbine guy, but there is probably, I think, in this particular farm, and this isn't a big farm as are some of the others are throughout Kansas, but there's probably 15 or 18 landowners that are involved in this project. And, of course, when they actually started development, it was good for the entire county. A lot of activity in the county, a lot of money brought into the county. And it is still good for the county because these wind farms mostly are tax exempt, but they, to my knowledge, most of them pay additional fees to the county treasurers in lieu of paying taxes. And in this case, for the next 20 years at least, the county, each local county, and this happens to be Caldwell County, will receive funds from Exelon in lieu of paying taxes, and it's a sizable amount of money. So it is helping everybody in the county.
Well,
now,
go on.
It's not all roses. There are some folks that would just as soon not have them. But by far and large, in this area, it was accepted with very minor opposition.
What kind of farm do you have? And earlier we had our biometeorologist telling us that farmers might see some changes in temperature that could affect growing and productivity of their farms. Could you tell us what you farm and whether you've experienced that?
Well, I do happen to farm about everything from irrigation to dry land. Mostly the wind turbines are on dry land wheat or milo types of soil. They're scattered far enough apart. There's not very many. Say on 160 acres, which is a quarter, there probably would not be two. There would be three turbines at the most. They're scattered far enough apart that I did not come on to hear any part of his discussion, but I don't think I don't think the way they space them that I see any effect in regard to that. If they were really condensed and close, which I don't know of any out in this area that are that away, yes, I'm not smart enough to know whether that would have an effect. But I would say the way they space them right now, I don't see any effect to that. Never heard anybody discuss it even.
Well, Scott Brown, farmer and real estate broker, among other things, in Mullenville, Kansas, thank you so much for talking to us about your experience leasing out your land for wind turbines.
You're more than welcome, and have a good day.
Now, Nate Brunzel is still with us. He is a biometeorologist from KU's geography department. And, Nate, I'd like to ask you about his reference to earlier experiments and earlier experiences in this country with harvesting wind energy during, it sounds like, the 1930s. Is that something you've heard about?
Just a little bit. I mean, basically about the same level that he was aware of. Yeah, using small turbines to store up, you know, basically car batteries, and then you would run a night light or, you know, lights at night or something like that for a short period of time.
Well, I guess what I wonder from you about that, and perhaps if you're unfamiliar, let me know, but the 1930s was also the Dust Bowl in this country, and I wonder if there is there any sort of relationship between those two phenomena?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think it's a little outside of my area, but I'm pretty sure the Dust Bowl is more linked to kind of larger scale agricultural practices in terms of the actual Dust Bowl and things like that. I don't think the turbines, it was such a small scale, and I don't think there could have been any possible effect there.
So are there scientific aspects of wind energy production that lead you as an expert to hear sort of popular discussions about this and kind of cringe or bristle? Is there a big misunderstanding out there that you'd like to clear up?
Well, I think, personally, I think that it's a really good thing. You know, I mean, we're moving away from the fossil fuel that have kind of caused the issues related to climate change. I think, you know, we're definitely moving in the right direction. I think that some of the estimates are a little too rosy in terms of what those potential numbers might actually be. And I think we should get those in line and bring them down a little bit and, you know, kind of look at what some of these impacts are. But in general, you know, it's a no-brainer for places like Kansas. As we heard about economically, socially, out in western Kansas, it just seems to make so much sense.
Well, thank you so much, Nate Brunzel. I really appreciate you speaking with us from KU in their geography department.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but stay tuned to hear more of this conversation afterwards. We're going to be hearing from the organizer of a huge music festival taking place in Kansas City this weekend, and we will also talk to you about the Royals. That's just a few minutes from now on Central Standard. We'll be right back.